CityCast from Explicity.
The Day of Massacre at Nalanda. Bakhtiar and his men play buzkashi in my alleys today. Monks are being burned alive, and those who try to escape are beheaded. Dharmaganj, the nine-storied library, has burst into flames. Smoke and ash from the burning books have turned the day into night. The sun has disappeared from the sky today, and even my bricks bleed. The sacred chants that once sanctified Magadha have turned into shrieks of a failing humanity. The light of the world is fading today. To face the ravages of time alone, abandoned, scorned, forgotten, or perhaps to be reborn into many Nalandas. The Rise of Nalanda. Forlorn under the red earth, buried for centuries, I rise today like a phoenix, 800 years later, from the ashes of my burned books. I open my arms today to embrace you, whoever you are, from wherever you are. Come, walk into my enlightened fold, as once Buddha and Mahavir did, seeking shelter in my grooves. I remember Xuanzang and Faiyan, the scent seekers from the east. I hear footsteps of Aryabhat and Charak in my ancient compound today. You too, come. Come as I rise again.
The ability to write well used to be a necessary qualification for high office. Whether prose or poetry, literature was always considered to be important as a tool of communication. It all makes sense. The more skilled you are in the medium of instruction, the better the instruction. The highest thinkers of the realms were always great writers. The founding fathers of the USA, Benjamin Franklin and John Adams, only to name two very good examples. They pursued letters and learning as a necessary part of their ability to create law and to govern effectively. Before them, we have learnt of several of the ancient Greek and Roman senators who were men of letters, and not to forget some famous Chinese emperors who wrote their edicts in verse. The mandarins and panjandrums of yore have morphed into the present-day bureaucrat. Of particular relevance to us, the diplomat. My guest today is Abhay K. He is Deputy Director General of the Indian Council for Cultural Relations. He was India's ambassador to Madagascar and is a career diplomat. But he is what is called a poet diplomat. Poet diplomats are poets who have also served their countries as diplomats. The best known poet diplomats are perhaps Geoffrey Chaucer and Thomas Wyatt. But that category also includes many Nobel laureates in literature, for instance, Gabriela Mistral, Saint-Jean Peirce, Miguel Asturias, Pablo Neruda, Czesław Miłosz, and Octavio Paz. Abhay K. is one of the few contemporary poet diplomats. In his words, diplomacy is generally conducted in short sentences which reveal as much as they hide. Poetry is no different. Abhay is the author of several tomes of poetry, and through that he has discovered so much of so many cultures of the world through their poetry. His latest book is titled The Book of Bihari Literature. This book opened up a world that I had only suspected existed. Every page came to life, and the biggest revelation I got from reading the book was how humane the text and how adult the sentiment. It is the sort of maturity that does not characterize any but the best of Indian writing in English. And this book alone would stand testimony to the need for more translations, not only of Indian literature, but that of so many cultures from around the world. Abe's understanding of the space and his skill in translating verse and curating those anthologies came rushing out of the pages of the book. It is an understanding that, not surprisingly, goes beyond literary constructs and abstractions and devices and straight into the heart of the culture, whether it's Brazil or Bihar. And this whole definition of poet-diplomat started to make complete sense. After reading three of his books, I am eager to talk to him, and so here he is, joining me from his hotel room in the Andamans, where he's currently on a work tour. Abe K., welcome to the Literary City.
Thank you.
In your writing, I perceived a sense of being. Does that make you an existentialist?
Well, I mean, these writings are kind of a, you know, it's kind of scratch mark on the fabric of space-time. I just wanted to share with you the first poem I wrote, Soul Song. The first line was, I was always here as blowing wind or falling leaves. And the last line was, I was never born, I didn't die. So I cannot say I'm like an existentialist, and I cannot deny it.
Aren't poetry and existentialism joined at the hip?
Yes. I think everything is connected in our universe with everything else.
Your particular ism seems to be people. Do I read you correctly?
I think it's the planet, you know. People are like, I treat people as part of the planet. And like, for example, I wrote an Earth anthem. I don't know if you got a chance. So
Yes, I've heard it.
So Earth anthem is actually, it says that, you know, united we stand as flora and fauna, united we stand as species of one Earth, diverse cultures, beliefs and ways. We are humans. Earth is our home. All the people and all the nations, all for one and one for all. United, we unfurl the blue marvel flag. So I think that planet first is at the core of my thinking. And, you know, everything comes from there, actually. Even my artwork. I mean, I've done also a number of paintings, and they all come from this.
Okay, so let's go to where the people are. Capitals. Your book, I'm enamored of the foreword that you wrote, and you quoted from so many poets from all over the world. It must have taken some doing to put that all together.
Yes, and you know, the driving force behind all that was to create a kind of, poetic portrait of our planet. Like, I thought that cities, they have a kind of disproportionate amount of influence on each country, you know.
So true.
And so what happens, for example, in one capital city, it sort of becomes representative, like what Moscow is thinking or what Beijing is thinking, you know. So it's like the whole country is kind of, you know, just one word. And and there's a flow of, ideas and information among the capitals than, for example, between Andaman and New Delhi. I think New Delhi and London would have much more communication.
Right.
And I wanted to see these capitals, cities through poets' eyes, like how do poets see their capitals? And it was a humongous task, you know, to really get, I mean, first of all, I had no idea who are the poets in these 185 capital cities.
Wow.
And so it took, I mean, years of research work and, you know, reaching out to them and getting them to contribute poems and some of them to originally write poems on their capital cities. So it's like one of my most ambitious literary works.
I can well imagine. In particular, I like that one from Mahmud Darwish. I think it went, in Jerusalem, and I mean within the ancient walls, I walk from one epoch to another without a memory to guide me. How did you get this poem?
It's a translation, I think. It's been translated by
Fadi Judah.
Fadi Judah. So Fadi, I'm in touch with. He contributed the poem. I mean, we read together also at Jaipur Lit Fest, I think in 2014 or 15 sometime.
And what is it that you like about cities? The history, the sociology, all of the above?
I think everything, you know. I mean, first of all, that in cities, you know, you can be yourself. As Great Gatsby quotes, you know, that I love large parties, you know, where you can be completely anonymous. Nobody bothers yes, you. Yes. So city is like a large party, and you can like can be anybody in a city you want to be.
And that very neatly segues into your book, The Seduction of Delhi. That book is all about Delhi.
Delhi has something very unique. And for example, the seven cities of Delhi. Seven cities of Delhi, which sort of, you know, one after another coming into existence, then, you know, leaving their remains. So Delhi is sort of a palimpsest city, you know.
Right.
You have still the old writings visible, though disappearing slowly, but they are visible. Tughlakabad, for example. So I used to go and visit these cities and, you know, write poems. So so Delhi for me, I mean, it's such an important, it's a place where I studied and grew up when I was in college and university. And that seduction, the seduction of Delhi is just symbolic, you know, it's actually seduction of something else.
One of my previous guests on this podcast, Pavan Verma, had this to say about you. I applaud Abe for falling poetic prey to its seductions with such literary elegance and poise. Delhi needs its own balladeers, and Abe K, it has found one.
He's been very kind.
I think you're being modest. You know, it struck me that the palimpsest of which you speak includes parlance, includes the influence of Bihar over Delhi. That is not something new now, is it?
Yeah, that's correct, actually. I mean, even if you go back, then you have this Magadha Empire stretching all the way up to the northwest frontiers and Delhi being part of it. The Ashoka's capital, actually, you know, Firozshah Kotla itself has Ashoka's, one of the capitals of Ashoka, pillars of Ashoka. And then you have his other pillars in Delhi. Then you have some of the Guptas, you know, the Gupta Empire. And you have Samudragupta's pillar in Qutb complex, the pillar which was brought to Delhi and which does not rust. Yeah, so Bihar looms large on Delhi, actually, even today. I mean, if you look at bureaucracy or, you know, politics, Bihar is central.
And that is so true. I know this from my time in Delhi. And this brings us nicely to the book at hand, the Book of Bihari Literature. Wonderful translations of prose and poetry. Straight away, if I may, one of the things that comes across strongly from my reading of the book, in English, of course, is how much more grown up that literature seems when compared to a large part of Indian writing in English, which often, frankly, comes across as childish.
Wow, 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 wow. I've just become your fan today, you know, because I finally found someone who completely, you know, with whom I can like echo or...
You know, and I thought I was going to get into trouble for my views here.
No. I completely like 180% agree with you. Because, you know, I've been editing these books. For example, like earlier I edited Great Indian Poems and also Great Indian Love Poems, 100 Great Indian Poems. Like, and these are basically translations from 28 different languages of India. I don't know if you got an opportunity to pick up these books, but like these are like treasures. And you know, why did I do that? Because I was fed up with the English language anthologists, you know, they editing books which were like, you know, Indian English poetry. And I completely like 100%, I told you 180%, like agree with you that it's Indian English writing is no match to Indian writing in languages. And at all. And in Indian, I mean, original like Indian writing is so much more advanced and so much rooted and so much has the smell and aroma of the earth of India.
Right.
And that's why, you know, I mean, I am myself, you know, I write in English, but my thing, you know, I mean, I grew up in Bihar and I grew up listening to the stories of my grandma. I mean, in Maghi, not even in Hindi. And my mother speaks Maghi. And I realized that, wow, I mean, we have such a huge treasure house out there. And what I'm reading, like these English poems, you know, which are like, they're like, you know, they're trying to imitate the American poetry with line breaks and all the, all that kind of thing and English poetry and so on. So, you know, so it's like, what happened? You know, what happened that colonial impact on literature? You can see that from Ghalib onwards, the things changed. And people started looking for blurbs in London and Washington, D.C. And even today it continues, in Indian English writing that, if you get a blurb from some Pulitzer Prize winner or, a T.S. Eliot Prize winner, you kind of somehow achieved something, So that thing, I wanted to break down, that thinking that, it's if you get a blur from so-and-so, then the book is great and you really count and so on. So I realized that, Indian writing in languages is so, I've just translated, the first Magahi novel and it's so good. It was like written yesterday. It's like a satire from my own district. And it's so like, see, it's such a thing that you can write the whole novel in a district. Locate it in a district and it still feels that it's universal. And that was almost a century ago it was published. So it's I completely like agree with you, 100% and 200% that, whatever you said about Indian English writing.
That's fascinating to hear. By the way, what you said earlier about poetry being broken down into strange lines, I have long had a phrase to describe such poetry. Inspired typesetting.
Very well put.
Well, you also mentioned Deen Muhammad, the first Indian to write in English. He ran bathhouses, started a restaurant, introduced shampoo to them. What a guy. Enterprising.
Seriously, yeah, you got it.
To be creative, you have to be a bit of a character, right? Back to the book. There's this wonderful story in it about the Hindu parrot. Mm-hmm. How wonderfully allegorical that story is. How brilliantly written.
Yeah. Yeah. The cover is,
Oh, is that correct, what that correct. Cover was about? I didn't even realize it.
You see the parrot there? That's the Hindu parrot.
Yes, of course. I'm slow. I honestly didn't make that connection.
Looking at the dressing table, which is another great story in the book.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Do you ever wish you could sit in on a conversation with some of your favorite authors and listen to them talk about their writing process, their path to publication, and of course, their newest novels? Hi, I'm Marissa Meyer, best-selling author of The Lunar Chronicles, and I would love for you to check out the Happy Writer podcast, where every week I talk with other writers about books, craft, inspiration, and how to bring a little more joy into our lives. The Happy Writer is available wherever you get your podcasts, or find us on Instagram at Happy Writer Podcast.
Yeah, yes, right. And that story is not only allegorical, but it's humorous. In fact, absurdist humor, which doesn't come easily to Indian writing in English. Great stuff.
Thank you.
And the other thing from the book are your translations of Dharmakirti, right?
Correct.
The one and only Dharmakirti.
Yeah, the one and only.
Brahmin rebel turned Buddhist scholar.
Yes, the chancellor. Or the professor at the university, Nalanda University, from where I come,
Now, his verses that you translated, evocative. Here's one. Every month, the moon attempts to capture the beauty of your face, and having miserably failed, erases the work to start afresh. And here's the other one. Making love to her lasts only moments. Like a dream, illusion, ending in regret. I reflect upon this truth 100 times, yet my heart can't forget the gazelle-eyed girl. 6th century.
Yes. 7th century. You see, India was, today, if they were here, they would kind of, if not only Dharmakirti, but also Vatsyayan and others, if they were here today, they would feel that, they're out of place,
Oh, yes. And this is a good time to be discussing the Victorian mores of the day. Like you said, if he was here today, we'd call him unabashedly sexual.
Because, see, I mean, the one of the best books on you know, exploring this dilemma is Octavio Paz's In Light of India. And, you know, in that, he asks this question. Even, like, if you look at the temples or the Buddhist, you know, like Ajanta or Ellora, you know, you see that, I mean, the all the places of spiritual quest are full of sensuous beings. And even so why is that? So Octavio Paz asks this question in his book, Exploring the Indian Culture. And the answer he tries to give, I mean, there's no one answer, but the answer he wants to, I mean, kind of propose is that, you know, you have to kind of be victorious over your senses to walk into the realm of the spiritual world, because you cannot go there with, you know, those thoughts. If these thoughts are still within you, you should return and embrace the world rather than, you know, go into, you can only go when you are like done with this. And that's why, you know, in Hindu philosophy, you have this artha, kama and moksha, you know. So artha comes first and kama comes second and moksha comes afterwards. And that's how, you know, some of the most writers of most erotic verses in India are monks, actually.
How true.
So as in Belgium, you see the best beer are produced by them. So
beer and sex, what a connection.
So it's because they are at the door, you know. They are in twilight zone, you know. They are like kind of neither here nor there. They're sort of at the doorstep of this world and that world. And that's how this comes from. Like the spiritual world and the worldly world, you know. It's the twilight zone. So that's how, you know, Dharmakirti can write these lines, you know, because he can feel that he's trying to enter the spiritual world, but still he's being pulled back, you know, by the thoughts of, you know, the illusion and the dream. And, you know, that the eyes of that girl, you know, and making love. So these thoughts, you know, they're coming back to him. And it can only come to you when you are like, you know, you are trying to cross it, you know, and yet you are not able to cross it, you know. So this is how most of these, you know, poems were written by saints, actually. And even if you look at other works, you know, so I call it a spiritensual, you know, spiritual and sensual, you know, both.
Say that again.
I call it like Einstein calls it space time, you know, no space and no time. Basically, it's a continuum. So I see it as a not spiritual, not sensual, but kind of a spiritensual, you know, where you have the spiritual and the sensual.
That's a nice construct.
Thank you. So it's a continuum, you know. It's not.
Yeah, I see what you mean. You know, years ago, I read this book of poems translated by A.K. Ramanujan of Tamil Sangam poetry. It was called The Poems of Love and War.
Wow, yes, that's a treat.
Those poems were about women exchanging some rather frank thoughts around the first century A.D., go figure. And while we are on matters sentient, let's talk about your book, The Alphabets of Latin America.
So The Alphabets of Latin America is kind of a homage to the poet diplomats of Latin America. And, you know, I chose to serve in Latin America as a diplomat because I was, you know, paying a tribute to what Octavio Paz did for India and to other writers, poet diplomats, actually, like Neruda and Gabriela Mistral and so on. So they were my alphabets, you know, and that's how the book is named, The Alphabets of Latin America.
Right. And the parallels between you and Neruda are inescapable, aren't they?
Well, so yeah, I mean, the poet diplomats, actually. So I tried to find a connection between, you know, poetry and diplomacy, and I found it. Poetry and diplomacy, I mean, both as a poet and a diplomat, you deal with words and how to use words, you know, carefully. Then there is this ambiguity, what Emily Dickinson says, tell it, but tell it slant, what diplomats do and poets should do, you know. And so you're not too obvious about what you say. And then there is brevity of expression. So you say more in less. Use minimalism. More is less.
The other way.
Sorry, less is more.
You know, reading that book, it became clear to me that Brazil had touched you very deeply.
Well, I learned Portuguese, how to speak Portuguese. And then, you know, the 3 years I spent lots of time with poets there. I ended up translating them and, you know, doing a book on Brazilian poetry called New Brazilian Poems.
Wow.
So I was inspired by Elizabeth Bishop and the anthology she did on Brazil. And so I wanted to do something similar. And then I ended up translating 60 Brazilian poets into English.
Mm-hmm.
And an anthology came out known as New Brazilian Poems.
Right.
And then I did a book on Brasilia, the city which was founded, you know, as the new capital of Brazil, and the prophecy of Brasilia. I mean, it's a city founded on a prophecy of an Italian saint.
Yes. Right.
And I wrote those poems to kind of bring more life to the city, to create these mythologies, to create these, you know, beautiful poems about the city.
Your passion for that city and that country comes through very clearly, which is summed up in that poem that you wrote called Carnival. And if I may quote from that.
Please, go ahead.
And I have known other pleasures, known them all. Pleasures that belong to grown-up men and women. But Rio Carnival is transcendental beyond all.
Wow, beautiful. Thank you.
You're welcome, but really.
You read it so well.
The point is that you write it so well. And finally, in what stage of this description of life do you find yourself now, especially since you too have lived in Arcadia?
I'm back to Delhi.
Oh, that was decidedly anticlimactic. Then that too shall be your Arcadia, shouldn't it? Well, on that wonderful note, Abeike, thank you so much for being my guest today on The Literary City.
Thank you for having me. It has been such a pleasure talking to you, an absolute pleasure, actually.
That pleasure was all mine. And that was Abeike, author of The Book of Bihari Literature. And if you believe that all literature is not only English literature, you'd be hard-pressed to find a better example than The Book of Bihari Literature. There's a link in the podcast description to where you can buy that book. And I'll be back with What's That Word? That fun segment where we look at words and phrases that we use all the time but never stop to think about. And that will be in a minute or less than a minute, depending on where you are and if you hear this ad or this fun piece of music. Back with What's That Word and with my co-host.
Hello, my name is Pranati, but you can call me P. That's P with an A, not another E.
And hello to you, P-E-A. How are you feeling today?
That rhymes.
Mm-hmm.
Appropriate follow-up for Abe. I enjoyed the interview, by the way.
Thanks. And I'm glad you like my little ditty, my little poem. So are you feeling better for worse?
Okay, that was not bad. Better for worse. Nice.
Good.
Hey, and I enjoyed your crack about inspired typesetting. I have heard it before and it never gets old.
Or worse.
Groan. Boo. You were doing so well up to this point.
Well, the point Abe was making about what I called inspired typesetting is that people think that poetry is something they can fake simply by splitting up completely ordinary and uninspiring sentences and thinking that will turn it into poetry.
Give me an example.
Okay, I will. Take my pauses to mean line breaks, yes?
Okay.
Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water.
Yeah, you're right. I have read this type of thing often.
Well, yes. So the measure of skill in poetry is easier to understand when there's rhyme.
And reason.
Yes, good. But the abstract stuff is harder to fathom. You know, just like modern or abstract art when compared to super real portraits, for example, you know?
Yeah, I get it.
You know, I once saw a painting in a gallery in Soho in New York, a white canvas with a large red dot on it, like an incorrect flag of Japan. And it sat unsold in the gallery for a very long time. Sticker price of $10,000.
Wow.
Eyes of the beholder and all that, I suppose. Well, I guess then people seriously think that their poetry is great because they have so much admiration for their own inner meaning.
That's so true. But, I mean, we were all poets at one point, weren't we?
Not me. I'm a prose man myself. And I never considered myself good enough to write verse.
Would you consider limericks to be poetry?
I definitely would. A form of.
Well, then there you are. Because your limericks are whack. They're great.
Thank you. I know they are. Competition-winning stuff, my limericks, I'll have you know.
I'll say. Okay. So since you're the limericks champ, here's a challenge.
Oh.
Compose me a limerick right now.
Okay. What about?
Okay. Write one about me. P with an A.
Oh, dear. Okay. Give me a second.
Tick. Tuck, tuck.
No pressure.
Tuck.
Okay, here goes. There was a young lady named P who insisted her name had one E. She said, wouldn't you if your whatchamacallsus meant the same as peristalsis and try pass it off as mere philology?
Applause.
Thank you. Okay, P with an A, what's that word?
Let's do limerick.
Okay, how interesting.
Okay, first of all, what are the rules of this absolutely superb art form?
That's so nice to hear that. Okay, well, as you guessed, the limerick is a very rule-bound and a rather rigid form of verse.
How so?
Here's how it breaks down. Rule number one, the length. Always, but always 5 lines. No haggling there.
Okay.
And next, the rhyming structure. It's A-A-B-B-A.
So the first, second, and fifth line must rhyme.
Yes.
And the third
and fourth
lines must rhyme with each other.
Correct. That's A-A-B-B-A.
Right.
And then the third rule, or the guide, if you like, is rhythm and meter. So the A line, you know, the A-A-B-B-A, the A lines, that's the first, second, and fifth lines, usually have 7 to 10 syllables each, and the B section lines have 5 to 7 syllables each. So the A lines are almost always longer than the B, and I can get more technical with the rhythm thing.
Okay, please do.
All right. Limericks use what grammarians call an anapestic metric foot.
What killjoys? What's an anapestic metric foot?
It's a rhythm of 2 unstressed and a stressed syllables. So the A lines each have 3 stressed syllables, and the B, that's the third and the fourth lines, have 2 stressed syllables in them.
Give me an example, please.
Okay, in the limerick I just made up for you, the first line was, there was a young lady named P, right? So the stress is, there was a young lady named P.
Ah, and a B?
In the B, the line, she said, wouldn't you if your whatchamacallsus would go. She said, wouldn't you if your whatchamacallsus meant the same as peristalsis.
That's fascinating.
And finally, the content. Now, usually limericks are filed under nonsense verse. You know, the limerick usually depends on a pun or some other turn of wit or twist of word or phrase. And more recently, a limerick is considered to be funny only and only if it is suggestive. Or even downright dirty.
That's what's fun about it. Okay, and what's the etymology of the limerick? Did it come from the Irish town Limerick? Everyone thinks so.
They do? Well, see where it got them.
So it's not from Limerick, the town?
Well, the town of Limerick has put up limericks on all their public signage.
What fun.
Yes. But like most etymology, no one really knows for sure, although the connection to the name is probably more than a coincidence. All right, so for one thing, Irish soldiers in the 1700s used to sing a nonsense song with a refrain that went, Will or won't you come up to Limerick? Some claim that in 1880, the New Brunswick newspaper ran a five-line rhyming poem about, it went like this, a young rustic named Mallory who drew a very small salary. And then they had people sing it to the Will You or Won't You Come Up to Limerick nonsense song. And so people say that the Limerick name and the form were connected for the first time.
Wow.
But I'm not buying that. It's a little older than that. Because Edward Lear, the great nonsense poet, had limericks in his 1846 book, A Book of Nonsense. So some say the limerick comes from the word Lear and Edward Lear. Lyric went to limerick.
So I suspect it doesn't end there.
I suspect it doesn't end there. I'm not buying that. Well, anyway, further back, again, we are going back to the 18th century, which means 1700s. There's this verse, which is clearly in limerick form with all the limerick attributes, written, sung by some Gaelic minstrels. And they dug this up and it went, I sell the best brandy and sherry to make all my customers merry. But at times their finances ran short as the chances, and then I feel very sad, very.
Lovely.
Imagine 1700s.
I know, and it has perfect form.
It does, AABBA and all.
Hey, say, has anyone been allowed to play with the meter? Like, is there any poetic license?
There is no poetic license for poetry itself.
Ironic.
Yeah, but you can play with the meter if you're making a very witty point.
Such as? Give me an example.
Of course. Here's one. And, you'll understand why it's funny when you understand that I'm referring to poetic license with the meter. Here goes. A forgetful old gas man named Dieter, who went poking around his gas heater, touched a leak with his light, and he blew out of sight. And as everyone who knows anything about poetry can tell you, he also ruined the...
meter.
Yes, right.
So you used the example of Jack and Jill for inspired typesetting.
I did.
So now do me a limerick with that nursery rhyme.
Okay.
You know, with the AABBA, meter, everything, and including at least one naughty bit.
Okay. Give me a second. Okay, got it. All right. Let me start. They went up the hill for they were thirsty, so young Jack and young Jill for some fresh H2O. Jack slipped on wet rock and put a rip in Jill's frock and caused her white bloomers to show.
Do it again. You absolutely should. Can you remember it?
Well, I can. But I'd love to do another one that plays not just with the meter, but with the rhyme and everything, except the structure.
Okay, go.
There was a young lady named White.
Okay.
Who went by the river to read. A young man in a punt stuck an oar in her eye.
What?
And now she has to wear glasses. Limerick.
I heart limericks. I really do. Okay, I'm going to go and try and write one now. Bye.
And that is our show. I would like to thank my guest, Abhay K, and my co-host, Pranathi P with an A, Madhav, and you for being here and for listening. Now, before you go, remember to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode of The Literary City. Well, have a fun week and see you again next Wednesday.